This is WZRD Chicago, 88.3 FM on your radio dial. Thanks so much for tuning in. We have a guest in the studio, and here he is, Mitchell Sapanzik. Mitchell.
Hi.
Okay, so we are here. Yes, we are live. There are humans at the helm. And we are, I have Mitchell, who is the head of Chicago Media Action. Mitchell, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My day job is a software engineer, but as my secret identity, which I'm not so secretly telling people and haven't kept a terribly big secret for the past 14 years or so, I've been involved in political activism, usually pertaining to media, critiquing and challenging major media structures, and also with producing media and showing up independent media efforts. Among the groups I have been and continue to be a part of are Chicago Media Action online at Chicago Media Action Online, and also on Twitter at Chi Media Action. Also the Chicago Independent Media Center online at chicago.indymedia.org. Indy Media spelled I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A, so chicago.indymedia.org, part of a network of independent media centers around the country and around the world. And I've also helped produce the Chicago Indy Media's television program called Chicago Independent Television, which airs locally in Chicago on KNTV Cable Channel 19 on the first and the third Monday of the month at 11 o'clock in the evening, as well occasionally on Free Speech TV online at freespeech.org. And also, if you happen to have satellite television on either Dish Network or DirecTV, you can look up Free Speech TV and find our show.
Thank you, Mitchell. Thank you very much for joining us and taking time out of your very, obviously very busy schedule.
My pleasure. I'm happy to help be a part.
Yes, we have to fight the good fight. And also, I do want to encourage people who happen to be listening, all eight of you, to call in during the music with your questions. We cannot take you over the air, unfortunately, because, well,
technical reasons.
For technical, but also for budgetary reasons. We had a telephone receiver for this, but unless we do something very awkward with the microphones, I'm not sure it would do you any justice. But I'm sure you'll have questions and comments. So when there's a musical interlude, that's a good time to call our number. We'll be giving the number out once that is beginning to commence. So That's the ground rules, Mitchell. I think anything else goes, of course, within FCC reason.
Yeah, I've got some choice words about that, but
yes.
we'll stick to things I can say over there.
All right.
But they will be still quite potent, I think.
Okay, let's get started with the first thing on our list.
The election.
Yes.
We're having one.
This is true. That's why you're on.
Yeah. What would you like to know or talk about?
Well, I don't know how you are feeling about the. Actually, let me ask you this: how are you feeling about the election so far? I mean, what's your take on it? Here's the floor.
Okay, I've got mixed feelings, although I am cautiously optimistic, as I usually am about these things. I think that the Republican Party has probably, and this is probably the assessment of many within the Republican Party itself, has probably driven itself to the ground. It may resurrect itself afterwards, but we are seeing what had been an uneasy alliance that had basically involving race hate groups, religious fundamentalists, and pro-corporate wealthy people. I'm casting a broad brush there, but there are a fair number of people who are wealthy who probably would side with Republicans. There had been an uneasy alliance among them in order to galvanize enough votes to be able to win in elections. The alliance had actually worked for the better part of about four decades. We've seen over the last like maybe 8 years or so a marked decrease, mainly because of the numbers of the demographic changes within the United States. And now it seems like the wheels have just come off and the train has run into a ditch or something. It is now become, we're even especially with the ascendancy of Donald Trump to the presidency, despite the fact that there were considerable resources to try to stop him in the primaries, they didn't just roll over and let him walk in. They put up a fight and nonetheless lost. And now we're seeing where, especially in the last month or so, regarding the charges, pretty strong ones, regarding his sexist conduct, I will say.
I would say inappropriate conduct.
Inappropriate, certainly, word. But it's
unseemly and
is not the conduct that he would necessarily do to men, but he has done almost uniformly to women.
Yeah.
So I would actually, you know, paint it with the sexist moniker.
At the same
time, though, I mean, but nonetheless, he can still be a jerk even if you're a man. But nonetheless, that his ascendancy within the Republican primary on what basically amounted to little more than a song has really driven a cleaver within this uneasy alliance, where now we're seeing entire components of the Republican Party base basically now at odds with one another. And this is not going to help as far as them trying to muster up enough votes in however many days, 15 days between now and November 8th, the election day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why I, as an independent voter who is, you know, up until I'd say about a month ago, I was pretty much unaligned in terms of my political commitments this election season. I was sort of bemused and befuddled a little bit, like many people, but I read a very excellent op-ed piece by Katapala in The Nation a few weeks ago, and that's pretty much sealed the deal, that in addition to some other things that Trump did. Now, mind you, I believe that everyone has a right to fly their freak flag as high as they want, I may not necessarily agree with what Donald Trump says or how he behaves or what he believes about this country. However, I do feel like he has the right to say and be whoever he wants to be. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he should be president. I think it's kind of like, I remember years ago, I'm kind of carbon dating myself. In the 1968 convention, I remember there was a guy named Pat Paulson who ran for president. And he was very, you know, you were just like, well, why is this guy running? He was just this regular guy, wore a big, you know, sweatshirt and looked kind of schlumpy and had a very laconic kind of voice, you know, really boring. But I think he was running as a form of protest against the whole political process to begin with. And I long for a Pat Paulson to be on the ticket this time around, you know, because, you know, I'm not so happy with Hillary either.
Yeah.
I do feel that she does have a lot of, if you'll excuse the expression, baggage that she carries with her from her tenure in Washington, being the spouse of President Bill Clinton, but also, you know, as her tenure in the Senate.
Yeah, she's got her own record, having been Secretary of State, Senator from New York, and a major figure within the political scene, also having spoken, and we now know this in the last couple of months, courtesy of leaks that WikiLeaks has received, that it reads to me like she's basically part of that kind of same corporate behemoth, you know, speaking glowingly about Goldman Sachs and so forth.
And another reason why you can't really snuggle up to her and say, oh, yeah, nice candidate. No.
Right.
You're like, okay, it's kind of like choosing between the Hunchback of Notre Dame and, you know, a puppy. I just don't know if it's within the realm of our bulldog. I don't know if it's kind of like that kind of a choice. It's just not a very easy choice to make. But what pushed me over the edge, I think, finally, was just the situation that I really felt. And this was echoed because you introduced me to John Oliver, so now I'm a huge John Oliver fan, is the fact that he doesn't have concrete policy positions, because I believe what you just said earlier about the Republican Party, the big tent is starting to rip apart.
Right.
It's starting to come apart.
Or at least what they'd assembled as their tent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think it used to be that the Republicans had a very consistent brand. right? They had, less government, more personal responsibility, family values. I mean, these all kind of like were in a package, I think, that pretty much was typified under the Reagan presidency. That's how it was branded back then.
Right.
But of course, Reagan was a kind of like the apex. He was really a brand in the making during the 70s. It was really back in the 70s that they were starting to really build upon the Reagan presidency.
It was in the wake of the old Goldwater loss that they realizing, okay, we need to, what do we do? And this was basically what they wound up doing,
so it took
assembling this coalition to win, and it worked for four decades.
For a very long time.
Yeah.
And then we had the contract with America and the battles the battle supreme that occurred when Bill Clinton was president and so on. So, you know, now that this behemoth is starting to come apart, I don't think that Donald Trump, as a Republican, really has a good message to sell to me in terms of policy.
Yeah.
And so I could sort of like, I'm sort of like willing to look past certain personal indiscretions and personal behavior as long as the politics seem to be, you know, online or on point. But I can't even, there's nothing to argue with. I can't argue with his behavior. It's just, I don't think the man is qualified to be in that kind of executorial position.
The Republicans have also kind of shot themselves in the foot and probably more like, you know, incinerated their entire leg by virtue of the fact that they kind of gambled regarding their demographic base.
Absolutely.
And in fact, we can even see this in the 1980s, that was, unless they took serious efforts to diversify their portfolio, so to speak, don't just appeal to evangelical white men. You're basically asking to lose generations down the road. And that's what wound up happening. I mean, even just after 2012, Mitt Romney lost, Republicans lost the White House, and they're realizing, oh crap, we got to do something about this. But they had actually made policy recommendations. We need to reach out to, you know, Hispanics. We need to reach out to people who would be advisable regarding immigration issues. We need to reach out to women. We need to reach out to independent voters.
Yeah.
That they realized what they needed to do, draw up policy positions, and did they try to carry that out? Well, the answer is no.
Yeah.
And now they're going to pay, well, not, they're definitely going to pay the price this time go around. They're going to almost certainly lose the presidential election. There's a very good chance they will probably also lose the Senate, which they have. They need to maintain at least 4 seats in the majority that they have. They have to defend 24 of them, and the Republicans only need to switch for 4 seats. There's a very good chance that's going to happen. One of those seats will be here in Illinois, Tammy Duckworth defeating Mark Kirk. But at the same time, you also have Wisconsin, Ron Johnson losing to Russell Feingold, who was a senator and probably as progressive as they came among Democrats in the Senate.
Absolutely.
Then there's also Evan.
And when you go to Wisconsin, I don't know if you've been there lately.
I have not. It's been a while.
Oh, okay. I make regular trips up to Milwaukee. And I will say, you know, you'll see half and half in terms of political signage, support for Feingold. A lot of people want him back.
Yeah, the polling there shows pretty strongly that he's going to win.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, but
okay.
I don't want to call this a done deal, though, but because part of I think in some ways it's a blessing in disguise, but maybe not. I mean, it's sort of like, just before a tornado hits, you get that calm.
Yep.
Before.
Maybe a hurricane.
Yeah,
the eye of the storm.
The eye of the storm, right. And you're thinking, oh, everything's fine. I can go outside and play now. And all of a sudden, you're up with the cow.
Right, right.
Heavenward, you know?
Yeah.
I think anything can happen. And one of the reasons why I'm concerned about the election, and I think all of us should be concerned about the election, are the people supporting Trump and how.
Yes.
That, I think, is more scary than the candidate.
Yeah. There's a very good chance Trump will lose in about 2.5 weeks. Now what has happened where before is that open racists basically were shamed into hiding. But not anymore. Thanks to Mr. Trump, they've now come out and feel emboldened to, get engaged. And by engaged, that could actually mean some pretty dangerous stuff, I dread to say. At the same time, it seems like there is also a proportional involvement more widely among, I guess, a broader range of communities. And that's probably speaking to why at least the Democrats are probably going to, well, win two of the three branches. They could win the House, but that's it's actually gone from like impossible to it could happen, but don't count on it. I'd probably put the odds myself and my completely unscientific or quasi-scientific basis of maybe a 1 in 3 shot. Mm-hmm. It could happen if all the dice roll their way, and that's actually possible now, but I just think it's too heavily gerrymandered that I don't think it will happen enough for the House to also flip into Democratic hands. So we shall see, but the odds of that do not look encouraging, at least for the Democrats. But at the same time, though, I mean, we're just talking about the two major parties who are also flush with corporate cash and who, in a lot of ways, are beholden to corporate interests.
Yes.
Never mind the efforts by third parties or other independent political efforts to try to enter that sphere, where that's very hard to in our non-parliamentary system here in the United States. The one metaphor I heard is like it's like trying to build a skyscraper starting on the 20th floor. It trying to build that in without that base and without that helpful infrastructure is immensely hard. There are efforts, and folks actually, I'm happy to report, seem like they know about them, and they're being acknowledged even within the media themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Where 16 years ago, the Ralph Nader campaign was acknowledged but was dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
Here, now in 2016, the second presidential running of candidate Jill Stein on the Green Party ticket, along with that of Gary Johnson. They're getting interviews on major corporate outlets. You can see Jill Stein on CNN or Gary Johnson on MSNBC and so forth.
You wouldn't have even seen 4 years ago, I dare say, because...
at least not to the extent we're seeing now.
Absolutely.
And that's a good thing, I think.
No, I do. I absolutely do. And it's encouraging, although I think John Oliver did a really good job skewering both of them.
Right. No. Just last Sunday, last week tonight with John Oliver, had a segment, a very long one, on third parties, in which they focused in depth on Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, candidate for president in 2016, and Jill Stein, mm-hmm. Green Party candidate for president in 2016.
And
exposed both of their, not just their own, individual peccadilloes, like the fact that Gary Johnson didn't know what Aleppo was or couldn't name a sitting head of state, except for, we needed help from William Weld, his vice presidential running mate, to try to remember the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox. That was two presidencies ago, by the way.
Yes.
It's like if I asked you, name a president, and you came up with Bill Clinton. And it's been a while ago. you're a little behind the times.
When I'm looking, as a person who is concerned about my own interests, I want to make sure. I was telling a friend of mine this morning that up until the Aleppo gaffe by Gary Johnson, I was, very supportive of his candidacy because I felt that I feel like, and Jill Stein, I supported my friends who supported her. But
sure.
I personally am not a Green Party person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm laying the cards out on the table. Bias is
at least you're open about it. So that's cool.
I'm open about it, and I'm not saying I'm fair and unbiased when I'm unfair and unbiased, and sometimes very arbitrary and unfair. But anyway, what I liked about Gary Johnson was his he was a true alternative, and he really I felt and I still feel that he is very true to the generalist libertarian principles. Although if you were a libertarian purist and you were a big fan, like I am, of Marie Rothbard, who is really more like an anarchist than anything, Gary Johnson would not necessarily fall in the category of libertarian. I would consider him to be a reformed Republican, more than anything. Mm-hmm. Because it's very telling that the Chicago Tribune supported Gary Johnson.
Yeah, they endorsed him. First time I could ever remember that ever happening.
And that, to me, suggests really where his politics really are and where they lay. And then that's kind of why I felt, that you would not have seen 4 years ago, sure.
That speaks to a little bit of the widening of the opening of discourse. And in a country like the United States, where that is the beginning of something probable and hopeful, that can make a big difference. So, I'll lay my cards on the table as well. I had long been a member of the Illinois Green Party and had been involved. In fact, my very first foray into electoral politics was involved with the Ralph Nader for President campaign. And so, yeah, that's where my flag flies. At the same time, I'm looking at the Jill Stein campaign, by the way, whom I've met twice, by the way. She's made campaign visits in Chicago, and I've had the good fortune to meet her and talk with her. And she seemed like an upstanding person, and we had a very fruitful chat, mostly on media, which we'll talk about as well in a bit. But seeing her statements, especially in the 2016 campaign, kind of make my stomach turn, especially with regards to some of her statements with regards to science and with political conspiracies. I can understand where a fair amount of that might be people who would probably vote for her, so that might be irking her base. But at the same time, if you want to try to widen beyond your base to reach out to voters who might appeal to you, I don't think those are the kinds of things that you should say or should support.
Well, okay, let's just say you are a conspiracy. I mean, I believe in some conspiracies, but... Who doesn't? I mean, I think there's a poltergeist in my apartment. I mean, that's why I can't find my keys in the morning. Whatever. I mean, we all have our personal eccentricities. But when it comes to running for public office, my belief is, you know, like you just said, you want to make sure that you're willing to acknowledge the diversity of and panoply of views, and that your views are very general but not very specific. And I think if you were to make a conspiracy theory part of your platform and you make that part of your strategy, I think that has a tendency to implode. I mean, you could see that with Ron Paul.
Candidacy, former representative from Texas, who ran for president like three times. His son Rand is senator from Kentucky.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know who, and now you see the mainstreaming of Rand Paul. I mean, he's sort of becoming more mainstream.
Yeah, he ran for president in the primaries and was regarded as a viable candidate for a while.
And he was for a while. But in any event, he's becoming more mainstream. They're not going back to, they're not hearkening back to their original conspiracy theory based people. I'm mentioning this to you, Mitchell, because you just brought to mind the fact that there are a lot of people on the radio, mainstream radio, that do promulgate conspiracy.
Yeah, and it's not just even, I mean, just listen to most any, you know, Rush Limbaugh or especially Alex Jones broadcast.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, they'll be throwing them left and right.
And you know what? and the thing is, fine. You know, that's fine, but you can't necessarily build a political movement on conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a difference between, you know, being in front of a microphone and also, you know, holding the levers of state power, even to some extent.
Exactly.
And holding these views and wanting to try to shift them. You not probably the kind of thing that you want.
Yeah, although I'm willing to entertain them. You know, I certainly find them very.
I've never. Yeah, no. I mean,
Rush
you want to.
Rush Limbaugh is not entertaining.
You want to.
Alex Jones, on the other hand, is very entertaining.
You want to. I am not necessarily opposed to hearing out ideas from way out there. I've in a lot of ways I've done just that. The question though is, what do you have to back them up?
Exactly.
So I mean, you know, sometimes some way out there ideas can be backed up, could, you know, have compelling evidence that, you know, prove them to be beyond the shadow of a doubt, and then you've got to rethink your thinking. Usually this occurs a fair amount within research in the sciences, which I've been following a great extent in the last couple of years. But within the political realm, it's a little dicier, because there you need to have the full proof that you're on the right track.
And not only that, and
that may be harder to try to pin down.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, you could say, for example, a good conspiracy is the mafia killed John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one, because it's coming up, you know, the anniversary of his assassination.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
November 22nd.
Yeah, a lot of people feel kind of, you know, they still wish he were president, you know, and... The thing about that is there are many different particular points of view, but is that something that you should run a campaign on? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I could see where people might give lip service to that to try to give, you know, especially where you need every vote you can get. especially if you're trying, if it's enough of a struggle just to get on the ballot. I mean, that's another another criticism regarding our system. It's really hard for non-big name parties, anyone outside the Democrats or Republicans, to be able to not only get on the ballot, but also especially stay on the ballot. And the tremendous amount of resources regarding trying to muster up signatures to be able to get it, and then withstanding challenges regarding that. Yeah, it can be a real struggle, and that could be time and energy that could be spent regarding campaigning or whatever.
Yeah, but I would say, Mitchell, I mean, just from what I've seen, and I admit you're schooling me, that's why you're here, is the... No, true.
No, thank you.
Donald Trump, candidate Trump says, you know, it's the election's rigged, and he's been spouting a lot of the conspiracy theories that you do hear a lot on, talk radio. Even Alex Jones, who's like a rabid supporter of the Donald, and it's enough said. But that, I think, is saying something about how the media is being played in this election. Especially since Donald Trump is a media star of sorts, and they're running this whole campaign like a reality TV show.
Yeah.
It feels like, don't you think?
Yes. That's especially Donald Trump's pedigree. I mean, I remember growing up in the 1980s, you would see Donald Trump, on TV. I remember seeing, it was a game show that probably nobody remembers, Trump Card. There was a game show, you can look it up on YouTube, called Trump Card. It was a trivia game show.
Really?
It was a trivia game show from the Trump casino in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Every participant wore evening gowns or suits, or in the case of a host, a tuxedo. And they were, answering trivia questions. It was an interesting thing. But yeah, I mean, that played off all of The Art of the Deal. And I mean, The Apprentice was kind of like the capstone of that. For seven seasons on NBC, he was, and it was a pretty popular show, especially when it started off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, and the reason they had him is because he was a big name who, had business savvy and acumen, and would, as we roll our eyes, and, very quickly and astutely be able to judge people's characters and business plans and so forth. So he was able to basically milk that off for 7 years.
And you know what? He is really the father of reality TV in a way, I think. It all started with The Apprentice, I think.
I would chalk that up. Well, you can chalk it up to a number of things. You've got the very first program actually dates to a PBS program, An American Family, that actually aired for, I'm going to say, 5 years? It aired in the early 1970s. I mean, there was a PBS program called An American Family. Basically followed the family as they progressed, and it was, for its day, eye-opening, shocking. I mean, where you saw, it wasn't just that families got into arguments, they got into heated disputes.
Yeah.
I think a divorce emerged out of it. One of the children of the family came out as gay. And then during the early 1970s, that was mind-blowing, a very big deal.
Big deal.
You would see like examples a little bit here and there in the wake of like the other big example I can think of, The Real World. In the 1992 was when it debuted. And you would even see something like, there was a memoir that a former contestant, Joe, and I'll never remember his last name, but there was a memoir he wrote called I Am Joe's World. And it was basically an expose of what happened behind the scenes on The Real World by a former real world participant. And it was, and the reviews about it were just kind of shocking, about just like, oh my goodness, it's just so extraordinary about how kind of corrupt it was. The big thing that kind of launched it as a genre in and of itself was Survivor. The father of the genre, and this is who I would actually count as the father rather than Donald Trump, Mark Burnett, a producer of Survivor, and is also who has his mitts and a handful on a lot of mostly reality and other television programs. He basically launched the American version of Survivor. Survivor, I think, began overseas. I want to say it was a Dutch program, but I'm open to correction about that. Mm. But CBS, with Mark Burnett, saw the idea, adapted it, brought it onto CBS, and it became a hit. Mm. So much so that it was aped and then copied and recopied, becoming its own genre in and of itself.
Absolutely.
Donald Trump just kind of rode that wave.
He did.
Maybe to newer heights, but it wasn't like he wasn't the name. People knew who he was. That's why they picked him as your main picture of that.
Yeah.
The best book I've seen about the genre and its seamy underbelly is a book, actually, a little bit of a disclaimer here. I am friends with the author, Jennifer Posner, P-O-Z-N-E-R.
Okay.
She wrote a book about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years by now, entitled Reality Bites Back. It is a very illuminating book, not only because it talks about how the industry works, but also on how reality television treats people who are part of their staff, the wannabe contestants, and also not only treats them, which is basically like crap,
mm-hmm.
but also demonstrates how they try to shape what they are despite what goes on the show. Like if you're going to regard you, if you're a nice guy, you're a man and you're a nice guy on the show, but yet they want to cast you as a jerk. They will make you cast as a jerk, even outside of your own, even what you do, and even outside of your own expressed wishes.
Mm-hmm.
They have tricks about this. The book outlines a great many of those tricks.
Oh,
and it is a shocking indictment, the whole book, but it's very much worth reading. It's called Reality Bites Back, Jennifer Posner, P-O-Z-N-E-R,
okay.
is the book. You can check it out.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I actually spent time in a carpool with a young lady who was part of the Dr. Phil show,
mm-hmm.
and why she couldn't get married, you know, because she was in her late 30s.
Uh-huh. Oh,
the
no.
They put her through. Oh, my goodness gracious. And that sort of turned me off to the whole genre of reality TV. I was like, that's not real.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, it's a thing. It's a thing, Mitchell.
Yeah.
And that's what's running that's what's running the media now. It's become like that. It's become completely, unprofessional.
It is, I think,
it's the cult of the amateur at its finest.
It is, I think, the apogee of a trend that we've been seeing for a while, where you want, to no surprise and to the admission of all the powers involved, the major media in the United States are out there to make a buck. And I want to do whatever they can, not only to do that, but to also cut costs, because that would amount to more savings and more money in their pockets. Reality TV dovetails nicely with that, because as costs go, it's kind of cheap. And so that's why they
union actors.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly it. It's like, I mean, you will see. I mean, yeah, you don't, not just actors. I mean, it's like an entire infrastructure of people.
Absolutely.
And a great many of whom are unionized,
mm-hmm.
and are aligned in unions with each other. And any one of whom could walk off the job and it doesn't happen. So you could see that as kind of like it could be interesting there, the anti-union politics of the emergence of reality TV. I didn't even think about that, but that's an interesting dimension. Someone has to write a paper about this. I'm sure a couple of grad students are working, looking for a PhD topic. I'm sure they'll be taking this up.
The wizard for plenty of them.
yep. So
here's one for you guys.
There you go. So yeah, but you're seeing that phenomenon where they will try to make it cheap, and one way to do that is make it like a quasi game show. Game shows themselves historically have been popular, not the least of which because they're cheap to make.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is just hire a host, have a single set. You don't have to hire actors. You can have to hire like maybe a very small staff of writers, 3 people sometimes.
Yeah.
You have an audience.
But Jeopardy probably has quite a...
They have 7 writers. I might be wrong on that.
Really?
Yeah. No. They have a staff. But
yeah.
but even there, as it goes, it's piddling compared to like writers' rooms where you have maybe like a dozen or more people. And that's just the writers' rooms. You need the actors. You need the stats. You need the, choreographers, editors, a whole coterie, upwards of hundreds of people,
mm-hmm.
in different aligned... and not so aligned industries in order to make a show happen.
Right.
And that's expensive. Right. And remind the visual effects, digital effects, a great many of which now you've got to also add in people who are savvy with computers,
mm-hmm.
IT people, graphics, coders. That's
mm-hmm.
not, now you suddenly, and they're not cheap either. And especially where, you know, they can, you don't really see a whole lot of unionization occur within the technology industries, among coders, among IT people, and among operations staff. But they have their way. They can vote with their feet, and they do. So that's where now, then suddenly they've got to now, you know, where the market talks, and then now their salaries are going up. Now you've got to respond to that. And that's an additional cost.
Absolutely.
On top of all of this.
Yeah. Well, that's true for any kind of situation where people are in demand, that they can use the market forces to their advantage
right.
on occasion.
But it kind of, you know, re-emphasizes what we've been seeing here. It's expensive to produce these programs, and especially where what trying to cut costs is possible, and also where you have, especially among a lot of television, broadcast and cable television shows, ratings have been steadily sinking to the point where they're now, you know, a pale fraction of where they had been even just 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So now it's like, now you're doubly stuck.
Yep.
And which is another reason why, I mean, especially where we can actually transition this to what's happened this weekend. A lot of media outlets are trying to do what they can to try to shore up their positions in other ways, usually through selling their inventories or trying to buy out matters, especially in the wake where a lot of people will be diverting their eyeballs to one or another position, a fair number of whom actually assemble a lot of audiences on YouTube.
Yeah, I could speak to YouTube quite a bit. Yeah,
go ahead.
I do feel like YouTube is the way of the future, or content-driven, I think it's now, it's here, content-driven media, people who choose their own content, and that is becoming more and more of a trend, and that the people who are partaking in more traditional forms of media, such as television and radio, hello, you know, most of the demographic for radio and regular, when I say regular television, I'm including cable and dish. Those people who are not necessarily computer savvy, who don't get all of their content on their cell phone or on their computers, that they actually turn on a television and change the channel. How quaint!
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't seem like. It seems like that demographic is getting older and becoming a smaller and smaller segment of the media market.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more content providers are doing more and more things wirelessly. And, you know, I'm just speaking to the choir here, I know.
Yeah.
But I think that's important for the election and how it's covered in the media as well. Fox News is an example. We've talked about this before, where, you know, the average white male 65-year-old guy, you know, I'm kind of stereotyping a little
bit. But at the same time, you actually are pretty accurate in your assessment of the average Fox News viewer, I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so so that particular perspective isn't necessarily shared by, you know, the wide
Yeah, so like an 18-year-old girl from Philadelphia or something like that.
Yeah, you know, who lives in South Philly, you know,
yeah.
in a group home with other heroin addicts who are recovering, whatever.
Right.
could be a completely different perspective. But you get it. You get the idea.
Right.
And I think that but who votes, right? And so what they're trying to figure out is like, okay, who's going to vote for these, for either of these candidates? And then they talk about the millennials as if they some sort of big, I don't know, like
amorphous group. If you were born,
and
or around 1996,
yes.
You count. Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yes, the millennials. What can you say to that, Mitchell? I mean, what do you think about that?
I'll say this. In some ways, there is that trend that we're actually, because of pretty serious changes afoot regarding our media environment, especially where what had been the major media operations, not only on television but on radio, both of which are increasingly seen by younger generations as dinosaurs. But at the same time, you're just seeing, in other ways, the emergence of the new evil empire to come. Here's an interesting fact. 80% of all advertising dollars right now in 2016 goes to just two companies. Can you guess which two? I'll give you a hint. They're both major names on the internet.
Time Warner.
Sadly, no. But try again.
Major name. Yeah.
If you want to search for something online, what do you do? Not
Google.
Google is one.
Okay. Ding, 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 ding.
Google, which by the way is the owner of Facebook. Sorry, I just gave away the second answer. Is the owner of YouTube, and actually a fair number of you viewers there. A great many viewers, and where that will be able to pay for ads whenever you watch a video. If it has probably more than like 1,000 viewers, odds are you're probably going to see an ad before that. And guess who paid for that? Advertisers. So now suddenly it's not that they're necessarily, well, they probably still will pay to appear on whatever, your local ABC affiliate or something.
Oh, okay.
But they will also pay, and then where you can also more precisely target who their key demographic is. I mean, if you're going to be, if you're, I don't know, Vera Wang, and you want to advertise wedding dresses,
right,
you're probably not going to advertise that to a man. So, but you can actually,
but
at the same time, so you want to, you know, cast a brush to more precisely show those ads to women.
Right.
So how do you do that? Well, it turns out that on YouTube, they actually, since it's part of Google and you'll have logged in as part of some Google account, they can actually assess that pretty precisely.
Certainly
to a great degree of precision than you would with a TV ad or a newspaper ad.
I'm sure the data Google has on me rivals that of the FBI.
And it's maybe even more so. And the other company is Facebook.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
That kind of divvying up of your demographic data into finer and finer buckets is their bread and butter. In fact, the Washington Post basically found a list of the 98 different kinds. I'm pretty sure the number, but it was in the 90s. 98 different kinds of demographic criteria that they can track for everyone, every user on Facebook. And that's now upwards of, the number is probably something like 1.6 billion people worldwide.
Is it really that many?
Yes.
That's incredible.
We're talking now approaching the billions. And it's not just Facebook. Remember, Facebook itself owns WhatsApp. They own Instagram. I mean, a lot of people will now say that, like, oh, I don't bother with Facebook. That's, you know, fuddy-duddies that my grandma uses. I'm on Instagram. Facebook owns Instagram. Don't just think that you've escaped their evil clutches. They got ahead of you there.
Yeah.
So,
who owns Snapchat?
Snapchat is itself, I think, still its own thing. It could get bought out. I think it's still its own company for the moment.
Yeah, I
have to double check that.
It's kind of like Tumblr. It's kind of like in that. You know,
Tumblr is part of Yahoo, actually.
Is it really?
Yeah, but now, which is part of Verizon for the moment. Verizon earlier, like 3 months ago, bought out Yahoo by Silicon Valley standards is a song.
$4.4 billion. Because Yahoo is in such trouble.
Yeah, Yahoo is not, well, they're at their peak, they probably were worth in around the go-go 90.com boom. Probably upwards of $120 billion.
Okay.
They got sold for the final tally earlier this year, $4.4 billion, which they may well try. Verizon, which completed the buyout, or at least on paper, they'll still have to get government approval, and that's going to take a year or so. Signs seem to be that they will probably get it. But here's the problem. Yahoo had been implicated in a pretty major security breach involving hundreds of millions of their email addresses. Verizon is now having second thoughts and is seriously looking at trying to get out of the deal, which they've already ostensibly closed, pending whatever government approval that they'll need to muster up.
I see.
So that might not be as cut and dried as people think. They may pull out of it. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Now, the thing about the Yahoo data breach, that's kind of mind-boggling. What has to be done about that? I mean, how did that happen?
I don't know how that happened. Working as a computer professional, I've got some guesses about how that happened.
Oh, well,
and it basically boiled down to that you didn't shore up every component of your website to the degree of security that you should have.
Yeah.
And that's a very hard moving target to try to track. I mean, I myself, I'm not to reveal too much about myself, but I will say this. I have been involved in security shore-ups myself at jobs that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. Not the least of which because you sometimes don't see them, but also you don't see the necessary attacks, but also that trying to shore them up to some degree of satisfaction can be mighty hard.
Yeah.
And it's always a moving target. People find and figure out new and exotic ways to try to figure things out, to break into things. And they can be quite clever, but at the same time, it's like, how do you defend against that? And I mean, now it's where there are now entire industries of people and staff and resources trying to figure that out. Entire software systems that are built to try to better withstand those attacks. And it's a constant arms race in this score.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know the particulars regarding the Yahoo Verizon matter, especially involving an email breach. They haven't been disclosed. I seriously doubt they will be disclosed.
Do you recommend that people just close their account?
For Yahoo, I don't know. I've seen posts, but I've not exactly looked into detail that they've tried to make the case that the answer is yes, precisely because of that breach. I suppose it depends on how vital you consider your Yahoo email address is.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Yahoo email address. I'm keeping it open because I don't consider it terribly vital. I haven't put anything terribly involved in myself involving the Yahoo ecosystem. I do maintain a Flickr account,
mm-hmm.
Flickr being a photo sharing resource that's owned by Yahoo, which I'll post things on from time to time as a kind of a vanity project to keep photos I'll take from over the years.
Yeah.
So I'll do that, but I won't keep it out. I suppose it depends on how vital you consider it. If you think it's you really need to keep it secret, it might be a smart move.
Hmm.
I haven't been convinced, but to be fair, I haven't looked into it terribly deeply.
Yeah,
I could be sold either way.
Yeah, me too. I've been giving it some consideration, but I'm not giving it too much consideration. I think, you know, anyone who wants to steal my identity, they're going to be rejected for a couple
of months. My joke is,
33% on their credit card. They're going to say, what?
My joke is, and I've actually tweeted about this, that I am convinced that the FBI has 8 different files on me, one for each of a different misspelling of my last name.
Yeah, I'm sure. Same here.
So I'm sure that that's probably the case with Yahoo, too.
When you have weird names like ours, you know, with many vowels.
Or in my case, a paucity of vowels, but never mind.
You're a paucity of vowels. Evolve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Right. We're after 3:00 Central. Should we take a quick break?
Yeah, let's do that because I'm sure. But we have kind of gone off a little bit. But I do want to rein this back to the election.
Because sure.
There. You know, I tell people I tend to go out to the end of the universe, and then but I'll come back to Earth in just a moment. I'm just making an elliptical turn back to the subject. Everything's connected. Don't worry.
Okay.
It will be. So let's get to the musical interlude where people can actually call in if you dare. The number here is at the studio 773-442-4578. And because of budget constraints, I'm asking that you call during the music. Thanks so very much for listening. This is WZRD Chicago 88.3 FM on the radio dial, broadcasting from Northeastern Illinois University. I do have to issue a waiver here. The views expressed on this show are those of the speakers and not of the station, any of the other students here at WZRD, or any of the other DJs, or the station, or the university, or even people down the block. It's just ours and ours alone. So thank you very much for listening, and again, the number is 773-442-4578. We'll take your questions off the air after we play the musical interlude. Thank you so much for listening. We're back live here at WZRD Chicago. I have a guest speaker. His name is Speaker. Yeah. fellow DJ here. Colleague, comrade at arms, Mitchell Sapanczyk from Chicago Media Action, and talking about the election, talking about the all the things that are going on in the world right now. And we were talking about the data breach at Yahoo, but that was kind of a side step to talking about millennials and the different media usage of millennials and how that has an impact on how information is disseminated and who is paying attention to the election, how people are participating in it. And so, Mitchell, we were heading in that direction, and that's mm-hmm. where we really should head
yeah.
back to.
Yeah, the demographics of it are such that increasingly the, quote, old media, unquote, particularly television, radio, and newspapers, are simply not being consumed at rates that historically they've been. They're, in the case of newspapers, they're still profitable, but by profit margins where historically they've been in the range of about 20 to 25%, they can, there's in some, a lot of cases still profitable, but to the extent of it maybe being 5%. Now, by that standard, that basically means that the major newspaper companies and major media conglomerates that own newspapers regard that as a losing proposition. And that's a big reason why we've actually been seeing newspapers fold left and right, and the disillusion of the edifice of journalism among the and within the United States that have long been subsidized by newspaper apparatus in the United States for the better part of 150 years, now getting all unglued in the last decade and change.
Well, our newspapers are changing form, I think. We don't have the traditional newspapers as we did in days of yore, you're right. And yeah, the statistics and the numbers actually bear that out. I mean, I actually met someone from South Africa last summer, and he asked me what to read. I mean, what kind of publications were good? Like, what newspapers were good in the United States? And that's a really loaded question.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, that's a real hard one, because I wouldn't recommend the Tribune. Too many typos. that's one thing. And Tribune is just not a serious newspaper.
You should write that down. It's like, the Tribune, we've got all the typos.
We've got all the typos. Yeah, you should look at their article sometime and just circle them. I mean, one time I circled like four typos in an editorial. It was kind of like, someone was drinking. or didn't get enough sleep last night. Whatever. Anyway, the other thing is there's a lot of content, but it's not too varied. I mean, if you look at the Wall Street Journal and you look at the New York Times, they're practically interchangeable. Not entirely. I say that advisedly, but you know, really, there's a lot of that's why I do both, because it's, to me, they're one big newspaper.
Yeah. I myself will we just read a lot of stuff on the internet. I actually have still use it, an RSS reader to actually serve as my kind of grist of the mill. And I'll follow a bunch of different things. Probably the biggest of them all, especially when we're talking about media, the Benton Foundation's website, benton.org. The Benton Foundation is a nonprofit organization founded by the late Charles Benton, who died earlier this year, but who had long been an advocate, media activist and advocate for better media, and actually had played something of a role, especially in Chicago, regarding public media, but of the PBS NPR variety. He also had been a scion of the Encyclopedia Britannica family. His family had been publishers of the Encyclopedia Britannica in the United States. That's where they made their money. But he also understood the importance of media as an institution in the United States and worked to try to help to make it better. One serious arm of that was the Benton Foundation, which is online and still doing good work at benton.org. You can read it there. They have a news feed that, when it comes to media stuff, I consider to be nonpareil. It's better than anything else. It covers them all, covers them fast, and is just a flood. It is an absolute flood. A word of warning, if you read this, you may be reading nothing but. It is
really
quite a lot to digest. In fact, I'm actually checking my reader now. I still have 194 links I still have to go over. Doesn't necessarily read everything, but just to get a sense of the terrain of what's going on there. They cover a lot. If you want a single go-to source regarding media stuff, I recommend that. Benton.org, and especially their news feed. And a word of warning, prepare to be overwhelmed. You may have to just winnow it down if it gets to be too much. For me, because I'm a freak who loves to learn, I can never get too much, so, and probably much to my detriment. But it is a good resource. I will also follow other things, mostly of the of bloggish variety. A number I will follow, for example, Think Progress, online at thinkprogress.org. I'll also follow Daily Kos, kind of aligned with the Democratic Party, but nonetheless, they do good summaries of a lot of urgent issues. I will also, I'll follow like the New York Times and the Chicago Sun-Times, as well as blogs. I read Polish, so I will actually also read some local Polish media, particularly Dziennik Związkowy, local newspaper, which has a very good feed, but also is kind of oriented toward Polish, but they do talk about some other things from time to time. And rarely, but like maybe in the order of like three articles a week, do publish things in English. But they're usually along the lines of like public service announcements. Most of their news is in Polish. So I'll admit that's kind of what I will read. The Intercept is also a very good resource that has come online in the wake of the Edward Snowden disclosures and is bankrolled, actually, speaking of benefactors, by Pierre Omidyar, who had been one of the founders of eBay. And it so happens that he had billions of dollars to throw around, and he thought, I'll make an online newspaper. And so he did. He actually hired away Glenn Greenwald, a longtime political blogger and a constitutional lawyer and prosecutor, but who had worked as a political blogger for a long time, including working at The Guardian of London. That's another resource, The Guardian of London. They said, we're going to make an online resource. And so they did. And it's called The Intercept. You can see it online at theintercept.com. And they cover a lot. That's also another flood of information. Here at in the United States, Democracy Now! Is also another good resource, particularly their website, where they will also, they have their daily weekday, Monday through Friday, radio and television simulcast,
which
WZRD is a proud broadcaster of and has been for the better part of 12 years.
Yes.
And also a little bit of a disclaimer here. Chicago Media Action is the local nonprofit sponsor of the broadcasts on CAN-TV. The broadcast, you would find that on Channel 19 at 7 a.m. weekdays.
Yeah. Well. Okay.
So we broadcast that as well there. They expanded also to other outlets. And you can also check it out online at democracynow.org. That actually will be where I will check it out most of the time.
Now let me ask you, Mitchell, I mean, you're listing all the really good stuff. Thank you.
No problem.
It's kind of like going to Fannie Mae and, you know, what is your
What do
Fannie
I pick? Oh, my head hurts.
I kind of, you know, I'll take the assortments. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Lots of good thought candy here.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, what do millennials do? I mean, I think that's we're like old school. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm not. I don't know how old you are, Mitchell, but I know you're over 30.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not saying that. You know.
I'll tell you. I'm 42 years old.
Okay. So yeah. You're an Xer. I'm a late boomer. In terms of age.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think we're kind of like the last generation that, you know, we actually read and research. I mean,
yeah.
I think millennial, I mean, people who are younger than us, people, I guess I would say, I'll just an arbitrary line of demarcation, I'd say people under the age of 30, okay, I think that would be safe to say, have a little different view of information gathering and in the way that, you know, you and I used to be. I mean, I think, like you said, the newspapers are losing their demographic because of technology, but I also think they're losing their demographic because their demographic is getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we acquire information and the way we learn is different based on the way we've been educated and what our emphasis is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with millennials, I think it's very different. The reason why I'm mentioning this is, you know, I'm very concerned about the way my nephew, who is 25 years old,
mm-hmm.
and how he was educated. He is a fervent, non-questioning Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't, you know, go to the Hillary campaign if you paid him $1 million, and he's very money-grubbing, and if you offered it, he would do something like that. That means something. You know, and the way, you know, when you look on YouTube and you see a lot of video bloggers who are, you know, of that particular demographic age-wise, the way they get their information is through social media. They get their information through texting. Their whole approach to, you know, politics is very different in many ways. And How do you think that is going to play out in the election? How do you think that's going to play out in terms of, you know, reaching out to that particular potential view of voters? How do we get them, you know, is there, how level, how much, what's, can we get them engaged the way that people of a certain age are engaged?
Yeah, no, that all important questions, all very difficult to answer. I'll mention a couple things related to this. One is that when we actually look at the aging, not aging, but the demographics of people basically within that, quote, millennial, unquote, demographic, basically, and we wouldn't even count 30 as a high end, probably like 25 and younger. But there, what we are seeing is that when you look at the demographic of voters of people under the, at or under the age of 25, what you're seeing here is a very widespread repudiation of the establishment parties and establishment candidates. You'll find a great many people, neither of whom are, none of whom, but a very, very comparatively small percentage of people who are not enthused about either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They're the same person now. No, I'm kidding.
Talk about conspiracy.
But the demographics about that are clear. And it's probably one reason why, and this kind of leads me into my second point, about the ascendancy during the Democratic primaries of Bernie Sanders, a great amount of which, even though the guy was older than Donald Trump in his demographics himself, he's 72 years old when he was running during the primaries in late 2015, early 2016. But nonetheless, power and with... early on, nary any media coverage, basically done mostly through grassroots efforts and a great considerable amount through the internet, but nonetheless had mustered up an effort and a campaign that was able to win 22 states, didn't muster up enough votes, but was able to keep it close and keep it going for quite a while.
Talk about a phenomenon.
Yeah, and to a great extent, it would appear powered by young people.
Yes.
By which I mean people of age 25 and younger.
Yes.
At the same time, that what you're seeing there is like, okay, how did they hear about it if they didn't hear it when watching the NBC Nightly News?
Right.
So they probably used it through, you know, their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed or a Tumblr post.
Well, you know, you and I are on Facebook. We're Facebook friends, right? And mm-hmm. So we see what folks post, and that's kind of how we formulate or, you know, our opinions. I have people from all spectrums of the political spectrum. I mean, I have Trump supporters mm-hmm. who are on my feed. I have total Jill Sanders supporters.
Jill Stein, you mean?
Stein, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm
now Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein are the same person now.
I need to get my intro going here. Whatever. Okay. You get the idea.
Yeah, I know. So, but yeah, you've got a wide swath of political opinions on your feed.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Well, good for you.
And it's good because for a while there, you know, sometimes I get so busy with work and school and things like that and all the other things that, you know, life gets in the way that you don't really have the time to go to Benton.org and read or to keep up with what's going on. And sometimes I'll just go to my Facebook page to really find out what's going on.
Yeah. And so in the middle of, you know, all the, you know, posts of, you know, babies and kittens, you'll see, oh yeah, Bernie Sanders just won. Just won Michigan, for example, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I doubt if there would be any cat worth it would ever vote for Donald Trump if it were able to.
Yeah.
All right. So, I think the millennials get their news that way. And I think they also are more inclined to pay attention to what's going on in social media. And I think you're right about the Bernie Sanders is that he came up from behind because there was a groundswell of support in the most unlikely places. And that was what's so remarkable.
I think here's what I would project as far as the next 2 to 4 years after this election. Mm. I think, first off, I think it'll be President Hillary Clinton and probably a Democratic Senate.
Okay, well,
but I will say this though, the policies will need to change to reflect that because they to make sure that they're basically along the lines of what maybe not 100%, but basically trying to offer something regarding the Bernie Sanders candidacy. Otherwise, they may have trouble. Maybe not necessarily in 4 years, but certainly in 8, and especially where now those young people are now going to be, you know, the movers and shakers and decision makers of our society. They are going to be the ones calling the shots to a great extent. You need to appeal to them regarding their policies and their priorities.
Yeah.
And that will increasingly also involve a lot of policies related to a lot of what Sanders had advocated regarding, corporate malfeasance and the environment and civil rights and women's rights and all of it.
Yeah, and I wonder, about the world we're leaving, what legacy we're leaving in our generation, our respective generations. I think the boomers have more karma, though, to deal with, because, what are we leaving them? And I think that's one of the things that I personally, in my personal mission statement, am trying to make the world a better place for whoever comes after me.
Mm-hmm.
But I sometimes wonder about my generation, if we've really done that and all the struggles that we've had. And I think it's a mixed bag. I think in some ways, yeah, we've done so much to improve. For example, I can speak directly to the idea of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think that what's really encouraging to me, to some extent, was when Donald Trump was on record of saying some very scurrilous things about women.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't to say that other men haven't said scurrilous things about women.
To be sure, but at the same time, they're not running for president of a major party for the biggest office in the land.
But the fact that that it would be considered, before the second wave of feminism, I think those kinds of comments probably wouldn't have been aired in quite the same way. But there was a very patronizing view of women and what they were capable of, and there was separate spheres, and I think women had some rights, and certainly the right of suffrage after the 1920s, but it took a long time before women were taken seriously to the extent that they are today.
Yeah.
And I think if there's one contribution that the baby boomer generation has done for, the current generation, is that we've made it a lot easier for women to be taken seriously, in terms of who they are as people.
Mm.
In a way that wasn't really taken, that women were not taken as seriously. And I could speak to this from my own personal experience as a woman growing up in the late 20th century, and how different things were from the 60s and the 70s, and how things shifted and changed. And then before you know it, it's very mainstream to see, women who are ahead of corporations, women are in the military, there's full participation. I'm not saying that women in the military is necessarily progress, but besides the point, what I'm saying...
I would actually critique that regarding women in the FBI.
Yeah.
1972 was when they first could be admitted in. J. Edgar Hoover refused to have women admitted as employees of the FBI. It
Absolutely.
Wasn't until after he died in 1972, the first state female agents.
Absolutely.
But your point's well taken. The FBI has not historically been a very progressive organization.
No, it's also been a racist one.
They've got a very sordid history.
Yes, it does. But in regardless of those things, it is pretty obvious to me that women are taken more seriously in a way that they weren't taken
mm-hmm.
so seriously in decades past. And to the point where, they are the linchpin of this election, and it is it's absolutely astounding to me how many Republican women are just appalled at Donald Trump's behavior, and are willing to switch party lines based on that, and how our media, I don't think our media is playing up the misogyny enough, but it is playing it up sufficiently enough to make it a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it speaks well of the fact that, women are, when pushed to the wall, will fight back. And I think that is something that the Republicans have completely taken for granted, that there would be, that there's always the evangelical soccer moms who, are conservative.
They're going to vote with what their husbands want.
Yeah. That they, not so much that, but to what they think is their interest, which is supporting traditional family values.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When, you look at someone like Trump and you think, there's not so many traditional family value action going on.
Right.
And I I know of a number of women who I know who are Republican women and stalwart ones. and are very appalled at the behavior of Donald Trump. And so I think that's something that is really, that's something that is not, I don't think that's something the media is covering enough, but at least it's giving it some consideration. It's taking it seriously.
It wouldn't surprise me to see if that a fair number of those, you know, standard bearer Republican women who would just be automatic votes for Republicans regardless would probably, by virtue of the fact that we have a secret ballot in the United States, would probably just switch party lines. And that will probably be reflected on election night when we count the numbers. And it'll discover that it not only, I mean, what we may see now might actually be just the tip of the iceberg regarding how bad it may be for Republicans, precisely for this very reason.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that Access Hollywood tape where was basically, at least in my mind, the final nail in the coffin of the campaign of Donald Trump, precisely because, I mean, as soon as it came out, you saw this immediate earthquake of shock, horror, and indignation, I mean, across all women and actually among a great many people, regarding that, precisely because of his untoward remarks.
You know, it's like him calling one of the stars on his show, The Apprentice, an Uncle Tom. You know, I forgot his name. But the point of the matter is, I mean, you just don't do that. I mean, you don't do that.
Yes, exactly.
Even if
you're not on a hot mic or you don't think you are.
Oh, well, don't, right.
Okay. But even so, it's like those are not the attitudes you should harbor. You should immediately disavow that, not just dismiss it as locker room talk.
Or when other women came out of the closet, so to speak, and said, you know, oh, yeah, I was on a flight or whatever. And then he says something like, oh, look at that woman. Why would I have anything to do with her because of what she looks like?
Yeah.
And that kind of level of sexism is, you know, I'm sure the younger people were going, what? You know, they don't get it. They don't think that that's such a, you know, they don't really understand that, you know.
Why should they behave like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying that young people don't. I mean, I'm saying that young people would sort of like not believe that anyone would behave like that. Whereas you and I would go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, of course, you know.
Right,
yeah.
Of course. So it's just his age, you know, whatever.
Old sexist jerk.
You know?
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's just the Viagra talking, whatever. Sorry to those of you who take Viagra. I mean, no offense. But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very encouraging point of the fact that, you know, it will be, quote, women's issues, unquote, that will be Donald Trump's undoing. Especially where he had won basically by this eschewing the what are called dog whistles, where you can't say, you know, if you're a racist bigot running for office, you can't say, I hate blacks and hope that you will be able to get votes. But you could say that I don't like welfare or I'm not in favor of, cheaters or something like that.
Or I'm not in favor of WIC programs. Or
social programs that
whatever.
Are just, you know, just handouts. What's the word? Entitlements.
Yes.
Yeah, the whole entitlements. Never mind
that,
like, you know, major corporate entitlements.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like in the wake of the 2008 bailout. Oh, yeah, they those aren't entitlements. Those are too big to fail. We were trying $800 billion.
Yeah.
No. Corporate entitlements.
Corporate
they're mooches.
Yeah.
Tell them.
Yeah.
Tell them to get a job, deadbeats.
Yeah. Really. Do something real for.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like do something productive with your life.
Yeah. No kidding.
You freaks.
Right. Stop taking over businesses and whatever. Anyway. Right. Exactly. So I think that definitely the polling data is definitely showing a widening gap between women and men in supporting the support of Donald Trump, which I think is too bad because I think it's sad and I think it's outrageous that it should be like that. I think women should be completely there shouldn't really be the kind of division that there is between men and women in voting. I think men should support more domestic policy issues. Women should be more inclined to support more other kinds of issues. I mean, it shouldn't be based on gender, but it is, unfortunately. We still have a long way to go before we get past that divide, I think, and that more speaks to the politics is personal, that women are still predominantly responsible for caretaking, child rearing, and so on. So they're more likely to be inclined towards that particular, those particular kinds of issues.
But as a group, women are increasingly throwing their weight around. They are gaining ground and have been gaining ground in a lot of industries to the point where they're now reaching parity regarding men. As far as numbers, we definitely see this in the legal and medical industries.
Mm-hmm.
We see women, as far as the money spending control, they, no doubt about it, upwards of 2/3 of all spending decisions are made by women in this country. That's why, you know, smart marketers would be wise to pay attention to what women are thinking about.
Which is why this whole campaign is really flummoxing me in many ways, Mitchell, for that reason, because I think Hillary, you know, I perceive her to be, as, you know, an intelligent, educated, even for the most part, keeled person who is incompetent, and certainly competent, to effectuate a executive office in a way that I don't think Donald Trump is, for the reasons we've just so stated, but that she be a candidate that would be running against someone who is so wildcardish, so rackish, so incomprehensibly incompetent is really sad to me, you know, as a feminist, that our first female candidate for president that's gotten this far has to go through this sort of, you know, that she's not being tested on
trial by fire, but of a different kind of fire.
Yeah,
it's not like you're being handled on the your skill and poise regarding pressing issues of the day, and also on your ability to articulate and defend policies, even when they may be hard to do.
Yes.
It's like you've got to basically make sure, you know, can you smile in the middle of a debate? Can you not interrupt? Can you handle interruptions and not interrupt the other person?
I mean,
I think she will still win anyway. But you're right. It's not probably the best test of the kind of mettle you will need, especially holding the office of President of the United States.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And it's not a beauty contest for those of you who were wondering. It's not. Okay. So we talked about that, and we talked about how the media is covering the election, maybe not covering it as well, and that we have to go through alternative sources and. In that we talked about how millennials, how we see millennials obtaining and participating in this election. This is just our opinion.
Right.
Maybe I should get a millennial on to tell me. but I don't know if they would want to come onto a radio show if it would be so uncool for them.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen pretty serious upheavals in the radio industry. We'll get to that in a bit, I think.
We should head in that direction.
Yeah.
You did talk to me earlier about the buyout.
In the course of certain events, certainly Chicago sports related, which we won't discuss, this may have gotten under people's radar. Just last night, October 22nd, as we're recording here on October 23rd, what had been rumored as hot and heavy going back to all the way back to Thursday, October 20th, where the rumors were first revealed by Bloomberg, basically became all but official, at least as far as the ball rolling is concerned, just last night. AT&T, the second biggest telecom giant in America, announced the buyout, which they've effectively completed in all but paper, of Time Warner. This is, for a long time, Time Warner had been the behemoth as far as media is concerned. They have really lost a fair amount and also lost their position. They're now down to fourth. But nonetheless, they hold a considerable amount of media, not only with, on the cable industry a lot. We're talking CNN, we're talking HBO, we're talking the entire panoply of Turner-related channels, TBS, TNT, Court TV, Cartoon Network, True TV. We're talking also movies, Warner Brothers, the Warner in Time Warner, as well as New Line Cinema, and maybe a couple of other prominent theaters, theater and movie theater production companies. We're talking a part of the CW channel television network, which they own in co-ownership with CBS. Where before they had also been a major player within the newspaper, excuse me, not newspaper, magazine industry, where through, that's the Time and Time Warner. They have actually since disavowed them. They actually spun off their magazine arm into a separate company that got bought out 2 years ago. So they still maintain the name, but it's not their big bread and butter. It's basically internet, cable TV, a lot, movies. But nonetheless, a major player regarding things, especially when it comes to cultural forces. They basically did the adaptations of, for example, the Harry Potter movies, the Lord of the Ring movies. They own DC Comics. So anything regarding Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, that's theirs. That's theirs. They've been part of Warner Communications since at least the early 1980s, probably longer. And that's theirs. So that they're going to also have a say regarding that, especially where movies are increasingly involving a lot of comic book characters. We saw this with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Avengers, and so forth. DC is trying to basically ape their success with the DC Cinematic Universe. We saw their first successful attempt as far as popular in at the theaters, but very unpopular among critics, with the Batman versus Superman, the first time the two characters appeared in the same film together.
Absolutely.
That's never happened before, but that happened just this past year, back in March.
And you can pull the roll over a lot of...
That's their start tonight. Of their what they're trying to basically assemble with the Justice League and their launch of the DC Cinematic Universe. Yeah. All of that would basically be under AT&T's Aegis. The deal was finalized last night. It was announced at $85.4 billion. To buy it this out. Just for the record, our wizardress has her mouth slack-jawed in awe about this. We can't reveal that on the air, but we will let the record show that this is a stunning development.
The court reporter is,
yeah, and especially
in
where back in early October, there were signs, especially where AT&T just finished their approval earlier this year of the digestion of DirecTV. AT&T is now your biggest owner of pay TV subscribers in America. Which they just completed because they bought out DirecTV.
Blowing me away. This is crazy.
It gets worse.
Continue.
In October, they were hinting at that we're going to look for other things so that AT&T isn't just thought of as a dumb pipe. This is the main criticism regarding internet service providers, especially the big three, Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T, that they don't necessarily produce their own content. They just basically serve as the conduit by which people get content from people who are smart enough and clever enough to want to produce that. Now, in the case of, and it was just in the last 4 days where we went from possible rumor to it's done. Now the motion goes regarding getting approval from various agencies. Probably, maybe the FCC, although there's some question about whether or not they may be involved, because not a whole lot of broadcast TV may be involved with this. The FCC might actually escape if Warner just actually sells a single TV station in Atlanta, WTBS. They might be able to not even get FCC review at all, but they will certainly get review from the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice regarding antitrust provisions. Now, here's the thing about this. I'm getting mixed signals about whether or not there's a likelihood that this merger will actually pass muster by government approval over the next probably 18 months or so. There's some thinking that it will because we're talking about disparate companies that don't have a whole lot in common that would merge. That was a big reason why the Comcast was able to buy out NBC Universal 6 years ago because they didn't have a whole lot in common. And that actually wound up getting approved with some reservations, which now the government is having buyer's remorse over because a lot of those provisions are hard to enforce. So there may be having some considerations here. Now it's like you're going to do that again with AT&T buying out Time Warner. Outside the business scope of this, we're basically seeing this kind of... consolidation of the venues by which people can express views. And we actually mentioned one name about this. It kind of crystallizes keenly in two different venues on two different networks hosted by two former Daily Show alumni. I'm talking about John Oliver, Last Week Tonight, which airs on HBO, and
watching.
Very much so. And Samantha Bee, who hosts her new program, which just got renewed for it and has been very successful. I love watching it. It's called Full Frontal. Airs on TBS, but you can catch it also online on YouTube. They broadcast segments of the show. She is dynamic, fantastic, funny, smart. I can't sing high praises enough. I think the show is, frankly, in a lot of ways, better than John Oliver's. It is, and then also giving perspective from a woman's point of view, especially where that is a boys' club regarding late night and political programming. She's the only woman among that set, among the major outlets.
Yeah.
The fact that there is even one is cause for support, and it's not just that. She is hitting it out of the park, to use a baseball metaphor. Mm-hmm. She is fantastic, in my opinion. And that airs on TBS, which is owned by Time Warner, which is now, along with HBO, which is where Last Week Tonight airs, are also ostensibly going to be part of this AT&T Time Warner behemoth should the merger pass muster. Both of those outlets would now have to answer to Randall Stephenson, who's the CEO of AT&T, as their boss. Where right now it's Jeff Bukes, I think is the guy's name, the CEO of Time Warner, is their boss.
Wow.
So that would actually change. Here's why that matters regarding democracy, and it actually kind of dovetails with a topic I've talked about here on The Wizard WZRD 88.3 FM a number of times, net neutrality. You will recall 2 years ago, in the middle of 2014, in the midst of a serious fight regarding the future of net neutrality and its fate in the United States, that John Oliver had a segment about net neutrality, a 20-minute long segment that aired on this program and also was redistributed online on the Last Week Tonight YouTube channel, which turned out to be not too insignificant as far as raising awareness and also mustering up support, especially where support about an issue like that matters big time. Usually for a lot of FCC dockets, if you get 100 people, that's a lot. The net neutrality issue, not just because of its pedigree, and a lot of people have been working on it, not the least of my own. I had been working on the issue for more than a decade now. Had worked to help to raise its profile, raise its importance, and help to make that reflected within the docket of the FCC and make an influence regarding policy that actually ultimately will help to shape what happens as far as the media and the internet are concerned. John Oliver's report really helped to raise the profile even yet another level, to the point where the net neutrality docket at the FCC became the most popular docket in the FCC's 80-plus year history. More than 4 million people on an issue where like 100 would be a lot broke all records and became the most commented. And that made a difference because when FCC Chair Tom Wheeler voted to approve a reclassification of the internet to preserve net neutrality, which then was sued in the courts and which the FCC won precisely because of that reclassification, they cited 4 million people, in quotes, as chiming in on this issue. That going back to how do you get an additional million or so people means that you got to try to win a breakthrough within the corporate media itself, and we did with that John Oliver piece. And that's where, and especially where AT&T was lobbying mightily against net neutrality.
Yeah.
Now suddenly he's John Oliver's boss, or at least could if they pass muster.
Right. That's
why this matters. Absolutely. Plus also if they may decide, oh no, Samantha Bee is funny and hilarious, but she talks about stuff that's too sensitive, fire her.
No,
they may tell her, you know, cool your jets.
Oh, yeah, they may tell her, you know, why don't you just talk about beauty bloggers and,
yeah,
you know, whether Jeffree Star is really a girl or not.
Yeah, yeah, not like, you know, pertinent issues regarding a lot of the stuff that she talks about.
Right.
Yeah, so now suddenly, this is a big reason why I think this matters.
Oh, yeah.
Precisely because you see this muting of even these, these ostensibly corporate voices, but nonetheless who are getting stuff out there and it's making a difference. And so now AT&T is entering the fray here as far as buying this out for a deal that's ostensibly done, but which is going to face, I think, some mighty reviews. And I think for two big reasons. One, we mentioned it before, Comcast buyout of NBC Universal. Basically, the NBC properties, Universal Studios, a whole lot of cable channels, the NBC network, the rights of the Olympics and the NFL, all of it. So now it's, but here they gave it review. They even had a hearing in Chicago where a number of staff, but the seemed the thrust about that issue was involving whether or not Comcast would sufficiently hire enough people of color among their ranks. An important issue, to be fair, but I think one I think they focused a little bit too much on, given the breadth of the issues at play here. And not to say it's not important and it shouldn't be covered. Absolutely, it should have, and I'm glad they did. But there's a lot to cover with that whole with the whole merger. Nonetheless, the merger was approved after a 16-month review. And for a lot of the provisions that they included in, that they had to require of Comcast, a fair amount of them are either going to be time-boxed after like 4 years or so, or, and it was the case where they're adding their net neutrality provisions, or...
When you say time-box, what does that
they,
mean?
It, as a requirement for the rule, for the passage of the merger, they basically say, okay, well, you have to abide by these rules, but you have to abide them within like a four-year time window.
Oh, I see.
In the case of net neutrality, they said, okay, you're going to have to abide by net neutrality rules, even though we don't have them at play at the FCC, and you're going to have to do that for 4 years. Okay, that I mean, 4 years isn't insignificant, but it feels like considering where these corporate mergers are involving for, you know, generations. I mean, something like, you know, GE has been around upwards of 140 years or so.
Absolutely.
We're talking about well beyond the lifespan of most people. In fact, all people.
That, you know,
it matters.
This is all breathtaking. I mean, it really blows me away.
Yeah. So that's one reason. People, I think the government, especially government agencies, are going to have looked at that merger regarding Comcast and NBC Universal as having been that they should have either put their foot down more with stricter provisions or maybe even not let it go through entirely. That would have been mighty hard. Their numbers were not there yet. They may have been inevitable in any event. But that's one thing that I think is going to be keen on this. The other thing is that we are seeing signs, especially just in the last couple of days, about how now a lot of people are probably going to be irked by this, even though that the offices of AT&T and Time Warner, when they were hammering out this deal, probably thought that they think they could get it done. They don't think they probably would have, completed the merger approval if they didn't think it was going to happen. But they may have miscalculated. Now, here's the thing here. Any corporate merger that has gotten at least 1 million responses in complaint against doesn't happen. That's what happened regarding the neutrality flight. That's actually what happened regarding Comcast's proposed buyout of Time Warner Cable. The cable provider arm, but a different company with the same name from Time Warner, which is a media conglomerate, which owns a whole lot of movies and cable channels. But nonetheless, they are going to be looking at that and are going to be wondering, okay, are you going to... will people be speaking up about this?
Mm-hmm.
My hope and my sincere, fervent belief is that they will. From the early readings about this, I think people are going to complain too much about it. The magic number is 1 million. If you can get 1 million people to complain about this, and believe me...
Efforts. People complain about this.
They will write to the FCC. They will do exactly what they did regarding the net neutrality docket. They're going to complain about this to the FCC using their website. They're going to spread the word about this regarding like-minded efforts and individuals. And we saw what that happened regarding the Bernie Sanders campaign, a campaign that was dismissed by the corporate media, nonetheless was able to barrel its way into the point where it won 22 states.
To be fair, was the Trump campaign.
That's true, too. I mean, as much as we justifiably badmouth Donald Trump, his campaign was also something of an outlier. He
mm-hmm.
actually raised points regarding corporate malfeasance to the point where he was able to resonate with a lot of Republican voters.
Yeah,
and then where a lot of Republican voters were deathly afraid of raising it as an issue. He was calling out against lobbyists
and
so forth.
And people who like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Who they consider to be professional politicians who work the system and don't work the system for them, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. And it's true. I mean, not to say that some of the things that Donald Trump said initially in the beginning of his campaign weren't true or they didn't have some sort of credence, but again, I think they don't necessarily translate well into policy, and, you know, we need someone a little bit more... qualified in terms of the ability, someone who has the ability to work the system so that some of these changes that they talk about are actually effectuated.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I'm very not sure is actually going to happen with a potential Hillary Clinton presidency. However, the issue here too, Mitchell, is we have to be careful about who we have on the FCC and
yes.
also our judicial appointments that are still empty, by the way,
yeah,
because of the stalemate in Congress. And
right, exactly.
The upheaval in the Republican Party may, and I agree with you, it may not to the point where we would ever get a Democratic
yeah.
majority, but it, that is a significant thing that we need to work on.
Yeah, no, to be fair, also, I mean, it's easy enough to, play sour grapes and say, ha ha, the Republicans, their entire thing is unraveling. Don't be too sure regarding the Democrats. They've also got their uneasy alliances as well, which we also, especially in the wake of the Bernie Sanders insurgency, saw as that they may also face their own day of reckoning regarding their alliances, regarding, paying the piper for alliances with corporations whose day may come. We may, it's still very much up for grabs. And we're in a very sensitive position now in these years where the actions that you take have an outsized influence on what you do. Don't think, in fact, this is the big optimism thing. I'm Pollyanna, I'll be like super optimistic. But here, there is good reason to be, because there is now an outsized involvement, not only with what you do, but also on how that can outreach. Can make a difference. We can see this when the AT&T Time Warner, when they opened the docket about that. I like our chances of probably hitting that magic million number of the number of votes that you will need comments from the public that would probably stymie this, certainly slow it down.
How about people who own stock in AT&T and people who, might institutional investors, do you think that they would support this? Do you think this would actually benefit the shareholders?
That is a good question. We have to crunch the numbers and see about that case. It might not. We'll have to see about that.
Because I would think that there would be some
sort of here's the thing. If they felt like that, I don't think it would have gone through.
Mm.
I think they would have crunched the numbers about that to see, okay, would this have benefited us as far as our share price is concerned? And if it wouldn't, you can bet your, we had this before actually when we saw they crunched the numbers regarding a proposed buyout of 21st Century Fox, the former buyout king of Rupert Murdoch's media baby with, what was it that we're playing out? Disney. It was a proposed buyout of those two. They crunched the numbers and that died on the vine. That never even escaped the board.
Yeah,
the corporate suite boards.
That might very well have some impact on whether or not this actually goes forward.
You could still see activist shareholders, throwing their weight around, and that might still happen. I don't count that as a likely avenue where this would get killed, the deal to get killed. More likely, it's going to be because of disfavor through other avenues. It's probably going to be in the various conflicts of interest that are going to be exposed, and most critically, where people speak up about it is, this is just a bad idea that's going to defuse, John Oliver and Samantha Bee, for example.
Or it's going to get in the way of, it's going to set an evil precedent.
Yeah, I mean, more so. I mean, especially where we've already got plenty of evil precedents. But at the same time, we have also in the last few years seen big mergers that a lot of people thought that a lot of corporate types thought that they could just ram through getting blocked. We saw this with actually AT&T trying to buy out T-Mobile,
right.
The number two and number four cell phone providers in America. Turns out they tried to merge that out, stopped. Just last year, Comcast trying to buy out the number one cable provider, trying to buy out number two, Time Warner Cable. That block got blocked.
Yes.
So we are seeing signs that it's not just always going to be cut and dried. We'll see what happens regarding this AT&T Time Warner. Signs are still really early, but reading the tea leaves, I like our chances.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I mean, but see how interesting that no one's talking about it. I mean, not in the level that it should be given in the media, because everybody's focused on, of course, this baseball event that occurred in Chicago recently.
Yeah, right.
But
to be fair also, I mean, this went from nothing to it's done in 4 days.
That's something that we worried about.
Yeah, and the
very
fact that,
about.
And I mean, just they finalized the deal and made an announcement late last night.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking Saturday night, October 20, I don't remember, it's the 3rd or the 4th, the 22nd yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. it's still quite new, but also not to surprise, not maybe there may have been some other consideration here. Might not surprise me that the people who pulled us off thought that they had to do it quickly because they were afraid that they have to do it quickly. Otherwise, they don't want to raise suspicions. Among
fourth quarter earnings report as well, because think about it that way, because October 30th is usually times when things get really, really fast and really furious.
Exactly. These corporations are flush with cash, especially with AT&T, and they want to make sure they want to maintain the hold of their empire and basically say, hey, look, we just announced that we're buying out the fourth biggest media owner company in America.
Yeah.
Isn't this good? That we're showing that we're with it and hip and we're the kids are and diversifying our portfolio and all this stuff.
Because this is the time of year for that stuff to happen.
We'll see what happens. By all indications, this is a bad thing. Whether or not we stop it, it's really up to us. I like our chances, though.
I think so, but I also think there's some hope in the shareholder as well. I think there's a potential there. All right, well, it is time for a station identification. So I will say that this is WZRD Chicago, 88.3 FM on your radio dial. So thanks so much for listening. We are listening to a conversation between this Sunday afternoon wizardress and Mitchell Sapanzik, head of Chicago Media Action, amongst other organizations and other involvements in improving the chance of free media for all. Right, Mitchell?
Yes.
All right, so we're going to go to a musical break. If you have any questions for Mitchell Sapanzik, this is your last chance. We have him just for a few more minutes, more or less, in the studio. And the number here at the station, please call when the music starts. If you have any questions, 773-442-4578. Once again, this is WZRD Chicago, 88.3 FM on your radio dial. Thanks so much for listening. Yes, we are live. Yes, you can call in, but please do so after the music starts. Thanks so much. And we now are going back to some music from Cuba. This is WZRD Chicago Radio FM. Thanks so much for listening. We have Mitchell Sapanzik here from Chicago Media Action for our last segment here. And thanks so much, Mitchell, for coming down and spending your very busy afternoon with us. So,
you're very welcome.
And thanks to your wife and your son for lending you out.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is family day for you, so don't want to take any more time than is necessary. But we have another topic that we really need to talk about, right? We're talking about our colleagues and our allies at WHPK.
Radio writ large, but we can start with HPK.
Yeah, let's do it.
I had been a DJ in the public affairs programming division of WHPK Chicago, 88.5 FM, the pride of the South Side and broadcast arm of the University of Chicago. I had been there. My show was basically active for about a decade, with maybe a little flits of reruns in the years after that. In late 20, was it this year or last year? I'm going to say late 2015, the announcement came down from university administrators that everyone involved with the radio station, both student-aligned broadcasters as well as members of the community who had been DJs sometimes for a very long time, I mean upwards of 30 years or more, had to register with the university for security reasons. And this drew the ire of a lot of community staff there saying, wait a minute, we've been part of your programming, you've known us and been part of the programming of this station for decades in some cases. For my case, it wound up being about 10 years. Shouldn't that matter? Shouldn't we get that pass, or shouldn't you reflect this within your policies? I mean, we should get something for this, especially given the amount of time and effort and energy we put into this station, and having it as a center of broadcast and local culture on the South Side, which, by the way, there are not very many places for that on the South Side.
They're getting to be more.
There are more. No. To be fair, but they're. And to be fair, that's no small extent because of a great many efforts on the South Side among South Side Chicagoans. Thank God for all of that. But at the same time, WHBK, especially during a lot of these lean years, had been a hub for culture and community and music, especially independent music, which is especially where there wasn't a whole lot of that to be had It was a reliable voice for such things. And I, since I had been affiliated with the University of Chicago, both as a student and as staff, I was lucky enough to ask for, it was actually a friend of mine who actually suggested I have a show. I emailed the public affairs producer, and we talked about it over the course of a couple of months, and he said, yeah, show, Thursday afternoons, can you do it? And I said, yeah, and that was the start of an involvement for the better part of 10 years. But nonetheless, we saw this policy change, which irked a lot of people, a great many of whom refused to have it, and you got to give them credit for sticking to their guns. They left the station. And so now we're also seeing where there has been, and this is actually has been reported in local media, in the Hyde Park Herald, the Southside Weekly, and elsewhere, that there has been, especially given the studio that old, reports of bed bugs within the studio that required the station to actually go offline while they do whatever you do for bed bugs, probably some kind of defumigation process. I frankly don't know.
Within the realm of possibility, bed bugs are real. Not to dismiss
the possibility, especially where, that can happen. So, and especially in where you're seeing a lot of people, a lot of whom may come in and out in a quasi-shared space. So, yeah, to be fair, that's true. But nonetheless, what wound up being an incident where the station effectively had to go offline for a couple of months it seems to me, read like an opportunity to do a kind of, I don't want to say purge, but it seems like some changes were afoot.
Well, these things are like pretextual.
Yeah. So going along the lines of a pretext, it would seem. I was actually, unfortunately, a first-hand witness and victim of this myself, to some extent, when I had produced From the Trenches, the monthly radio program of the Chicago Independent Media Center, which had, among other things, a broadcast arm out of Loyola University at WLUW. I had been its producer for 5 years. The show had been there 14 years to the week. It turns out what wound up being our final broadcast was aired exactly 14 years to the week after its original broadcast. It was just an uncanny coincidence that our show wrapped up that close to our 14th anniversary. And it was basically along the lines, it was Friday afternoon for the last show that was slated to be aired on that Sunday afternoon. We were basically told that we're going in a different direction, and thank you for your service, but your show is now ended with WLUW.
Let me ask you this: what happened there? What direction did they go in?
They focused away from having any kind of non-student involvement, where they had been having a number of non-student involved shows. I'm not a student. I'm first off not a student. Secondly, I've never been a student at Loyola University. But nonetheless, I had hosted a show myself for 5 years, From the Trenches, or served as its producer, and also had been involved with it at various spots over the previous 9 years. So I don't consider myself a stranger to the station. They know me. I've been more than happy to chat with and have known a number of people who have been involved with the station over the years. But nonetheless, suspicions about this are along the lines that they want to focus on student involvement as bearing down WLUW and turning it from a kind of community center into a kind of corporate radio training ground, especially where they want to try to siphon off tuition dollars from rival colleges, most notably Columbia College, where the same thing would happen. Now, to be fair, I don't have any evidence of this, but this is where my reading of the situation, based on what I could see and signs I could hear, I can discern.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. I mean, I'm sure a lot of larger institutions, private institutions like Loyola, but others as well, are concerned about online universities or alternative universities, training universities. To capture those tuition dollars, and they're looking for ways to innovate within in-house to get those dollars.
Yeah, no, and to be fair, and I even saw signs about this at WHPK. They were actually seriously considering allowing DJs to broadcast from home. You wouldn't even have to go into the studio anymore. They would actually work with you with setting up software and the necessary broadcasting equipment from your computer. You didn't even have to come into the studio. You could probably just broadcast remotely in, and if the connection works, you would actually be broadcasting on Chicago Airwaves from your laptop computer, for example, and be able to do that. There were serious signs about this happening. They may still try to pull this off. Reading the signs about that seems like that's unclear. It may take a while at the very least. Mm-hmm. Not the least of which is that they're also having to deal with this these various changes and upheavals that we have seen in the station, both regarding the university policy that's being imposed as well as this recent adventure involving bedbugs.
Mm.
So that
so
that
they had to close it, they said, because of bedbugs.
Well, I mean, that, and to be fair, that was probably what happened. But at the same time, it's just like, you know, probably not the kind of thing that you want to necessarily use as an excuse to get rid of, you know, your political opponents. Although, again, this is my reading of the situation, may not necessarily reflect what have happened.
What kind of opponents were it? I mean, I remember when I did have a chance to listen to
Maybe opponents might not be the fairest characterization. But maybe you want to focus on students because your university makes money off of students, not off of people who happen to live in the neighborhood who are not enrolled in your university.
Right. And
right.
So there is always that consideration.
Yeah.
This is true. This is true. So we have to take into consideration, you know, what is the role of the radio in the university? Is it a student club? Is it a reflection of the university? Is it an outlet for the students? Is it all those things and more? It's hard because when this newsflash came across circulated amongst us here at the Wizard, we were very concerned, and we are still very concerned about what's going on to HBK. Mm. Because it sounded like deja vu all over again. We definitely don't want to have a repeat of history by any stretch.
Definitely.
So I understand that some of the DJs are moving over to another radio station that we should be informed about.
Lumpen Radio, WLPN-LP. Lumpen Radio is part of the Lumpen Media Project that had been, it's basically built itself as a kind of independent media resource and community for a very long time. Ed Marshevsky, who's been very involved with this as a main organizer, mm-hmm. Had organized the Lumpen Festival, Lumpen Community Spaces, and also the Prosperity Sphere, I think is what it's called, a Southside resource where they have various community resources and where they organized a radio station and applied for, when the window was open for that, a low-power community radio broadcasting license,
right,
which they got and which they have now turned into. And in fact, I've just been following it on Facebook. Just in the last couple of weeks, they have just completed prototypes of their very first broadcast. Not quite done yet. They're getting there, but they just, you could actually just get an FM receiver and hear them on the air. They played one song, but they proved that it can be done. And so now they're going to be building off of that.
Okay.
But that's what they're going to do. And that's where a fair number of both WLUW and WHPK exile DJs have now called home. They're going to Lumpen Radio, WLPN-LP, low power radio, not necessarily FM. But you can hear it on your broadcast radio dial if you're within the broadcast radius on the south side of Chicago, with maybe about, I'm not sure what their broadcast radius is. I maybe guess 5 miles, but I could be wrong on that.
Okay.
They'll also syndicate it online as well, so you can hear it through your internets.
Okay, so they are on the internet. That's
here is one great irony regarding this kind of, what seems like it's a changing of the guard among university radio stations.
Okay.
They're doing what they think is a kind of service to their students by turning their respective radio hubs into training grounds for corporate radio. But yet we are seeing, and have seen, especially in the last couple of years, and this has not gotten a whole lot of play because who listens to radio anymore?
Right.
Yeah. but nonetheless, we are seeing some pretty serious dramatic upheavals within the radio broadcast space. A number of changes to bring here, not just the least of which is now LPFM has entered into the fray, but also where among corporate radio conglomerates, the big name here is
WLS?
I'm actually thinking of radio chains.
Oh, chains. Oh. Channel.
Yeah, well, they're not known by that name and haven't been for a number of years. And that's actually one thing that they did. They're now known as iHeartMedia, with iHeartRadio.
That's
Clear Channel. They changed their name.
Oh, wow.
Nobody knows about Clear Channel. You might hear about iHeartMedia, but it's the same company.
I did not know
yep,
that.
Yep, now you do. And now you are thus empowered. That's exactly what happened here. Clear Channel, because they had basically gotten, because they went so big so fast in going from a small chain of radio stations in San Antonio, Texas, to the biggest radio conglomerate in American history. At its peak, it was more than 1,200 radio stations.
That's a lot.
Not the least of which, and then they would also do cookie cutter changes, and they actually had pushed very hard to try to eliminate the remaining media ownership rules, blocking them from owning radio stations. They maxed them out in the number of communities at 8 per community. Which is a lot and breathtaking. And they actually were very close to overturning that, which a lot of media activists, myself included, played a role in stopping. Then it all started to unravel. What wound up happening there was that people became increasingly disgusted with the kind of cookie-cutter mold of radio, started turning off their radios, listenerships went down. Then you saw a little bit of a changing of the guard within Clear Channel itself. It actually wound up getting controlled of by a Provident Equity Partners, which is a an equity firm, big corporate people who basically spend and play with money all day, and basically served as a wound up buying out a good chunk. It's like I'll buy the largest radio chain in America. They actually didn't buy the whole chain. They actually spun off about a third of their stations, going down to about 800 or so. Buying that out, it's still huge. It was still the biggest radio chain in America, just not of all time. Buying them out, and then basically trying to do what you can, so cutting broadcast efforts further down the bone. Now, all hell is about to break loose in two reasons. One has to do with Rush Limbaugh. It turns out that Clear Channel, through a broadcast arm, is the distributor of Rush Limbaugh's broadcast, and especially where this was definitely the case, speaking of women involved with major male figures of a certain generation.
Mm-hmm.
Rush Limbaugh had basically gotten a lot of flack regarding his statements of Sandra Fluke, law student at Georgetown University who had been outspoken on her involvement regarding women's reproductive rights. He had basically made her a bugaboo, gotten a lot of basically called her names on the air, but the blowback against that really soiled his name more widely in the community, to the point where a lot of broadcasters became increasingly skittish, and that campaign hit them where it hurts in their advertising dockets and the amount of money that they could raise, to the point where not only was Rush Limbaugh losing listeners, he was losing cash, and the company was losing cash. Now it's gotten to the point where just this past July, Rush Limbaugh was about to turn 65. There was a real question about, and his contract was up for renewal. There was a real question in a lot of minds, people's minds, as to whether or not he actually would get renewed. Turns out he did. To a 4-year contract renewal to the tune of about $80 million. Here's where this is particularly breathtaking. Yeah.
Again.
I mean, and just that alone, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. He had made money, and I don't know if iHeartMedia, the new name of what had been Clear Channel,
right,
is realizes what they just did. Because, I mean, my feeling of it is, but then I was looking at it through like a detached viewer who's actually trying to pay attention to facts and evidence.
Right.
Rather than someone who, you know, likes Rush Limbaugh and likes what he has to say and thinks he can bring in money. No, he can't. Not anymore. His demographics are shifting. Radio stations that have been long standard bulwarks are dropping him like he's radioactive, so to speak.
Yeah.
Pun very intended.
Yes.
So let's give him a contract renewal around the time when most people retire to the tune of 8 figures and where he can probably shoot his mouth off yet again, and, you know, do whatever he does to try to raise money. But now Clear Channel doesn't have much in the way of reliable avenues of money, of income streams. Rush Limbaugh is one of their few, relatively speaking. And there's one of the bigger ones, except you're basically getting on the Titanic. You're just asking to sink and go down.
Yeah.
And that's why I think they're going to come to regret that. And it's going to come to a head just in the next couple of years. In the course of Clear Channel's immense buying spree, they put themselves onto debt to the tune of $20 billion, which they're going to have to pay due. The next big payments about this are in a couple of years. They're going to have to somehow come up with $6 billion to pay off their debtors. Otherwise, they will almost certainly get broken up, and Lord knows what's going to happen thereafter. And it won't be by the government. It'll be by their creditors, the people who loaned them money back in the go-go late 90s, early aughts, to say, we can just buy this out and no one will know and no one will care and we're going to make so much money your head will spin. But now people are smarter about it. They're savvy. They're not going to listen to the same kind of boilerplate crap that passes for radio in most of America. And they're shutting it off. And so now it's like, now what? You put yourself on the hook for eight figures. You have to pay due and fast. And you don't have much in the way of trying to get yourself out of this. What happens then? By the way, in the wake of this entire consolidation, they reduced the number of DJs. So that means that the DJs to be basically trained at Loyola and at Chicago increasingly have fewer potential outlets to be able to try to get a job. And it's now going to probably be reduced markedly so now in the wake of this Clear Channel fiasco involving their debt and trying to attempt to pay it off.
Now, could there be a silver lining to this playbook? Because I'm thinking that if they do go under with the debt and they reorganize, there might be a breakup of all the stations, and there might be opportunities to maybe expand or revitalize the diversity of radio.
I'm glad you raised that, and I actually think of that as a distinct possibility. It might not happen for maybe another half decade or so. But, and especially where they're increasingly, we're seeing what we may well see as well, an abandonment of the AM band entirely. This is what's seriously being weighed within the centers of power in the FCC and among media conglomerates. They may just regard AM radio as just unrecoverable, and they may just abandon it entirely. Probably the frequencies to be sold off to cell phone companies for increasing use for cell phones, apps, and whatever new technologies come to the fore for wireless technologies.
I think that's
probably what's going to happen. We probably will not see the revitalization. We may see it a little bit of a resurgence of radio programs, but it will probably be of the digital sort. Kind of like what Chirp did, where they will start out with, and actually, the Chicago Independent Radio Project, chirpradio.org. But they started out with a digital radio station. And you would just go on. They made available an app. They made available a website. They put on a stream, which you can do. In fact, I have done with my laptop with the right software, which is not expensive. We're talking maybe on the scale of $30. The equipment is trivially easy. It is probably cheaper to set up a radio station than it is to set up a website these days.
I bet.
Yeah. And it is, and if you want to do it, it is now eminently possible and you can even maybe even make a little money off of it, especially if you do something like, as I've seen increasingly, sponsored podcasts. You could do your own podcast, maybe have it broadcast on one or more arms, and get a sponsor who could, you know, pay for your rent or something like that. That might be where the resurgence may lay. It might not be within the radio arm itself, because that, at least on the AM band, looks like if signs seem to point to this, they may be slated for its retirement permanently. But we shall see. And it's just, we're seeing the scope of what could be very breathtaking changes in the next couple of years on all of this.
All right. Well, there is a future for radio, perhaps. I sometimes wonder about that a lot. You know, speaking candidly, I think that there is an opportunity, but there are lots of problems. You know, there are many problems with shrinking demographics, increased corporatization.
Yeah.
One of the trends that I read about and I've been reading about and sort of following is a lot of colleges and universities are selling their stations to corporate conglomerates like National Public Radio and so on and so forth.
That has happened as well. We actually saw an example of that actually here in Chicago. Radio Arte. which was a broadcast arm of the Mexican Fine Arts Center, WRTE on the south side. The broadcast signal was at 90.5. They were, and they prided themselves as being a community station, so that you would actually see teenagers band together and make radio programs, and good ones, too. They also aired Democracy Now! For a time, in fact. But yet, they for whatever reasons, a lot of which I've not heard, the museum decided to sell the station to WBEZ. And so we actually saw that. So that's now whatever it is now.
Yeah.
But you know, and it was a shame, I think.
And I think National Public Radio is an interesting case study in and of itself, worth its own show, actually.
Yeah.
About its evolution and change in terms of being a corporate media outlet of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
You know, you can listen to National Public Radio, and it's almost undistinguishable, practically, in some from some iHeart stations. Although maybe there's a little less commercial,
maybe a little
classier voices, maybe a little bit more, higher level, talk.
The example I hear when comparing PBS and NPR with their corporate brethren is that they're better, but they're not dramatically better.
Right.
And I think that's the case here. So you won't hear shock jocks who are going to, spew insults and make fart sounds or whatever they're going to do, but they'll be respectful. You'll actually have a dialogue. You may actually learn some things, but they'll be like the broadcast equivalent of a warm glass of milk. It's nothing, not going to upset you too much, probably. But at the same time, it also won't say the things that frankly need to be said and should be said,
right.
Especially where you're seeing, going back to younger generations who are increasingly dissatisfied with the media outlets and seeing, and in many cases, forging their own. That they're hungry for alternatives. I think a lot of people are, and then we do it ourselves. Try to do what we can to help to shore those up.
Yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of people are clinging on to things. They're clinging on to the wrong targets. Actually,
mm-hmm.
I understand people are upset and that they don't like the way the status quo. But the representative of that, iconoclastic rhetoric is not necessarily the best representative of the rest of us.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking of Donald Trump, obviously. And at the same time, I think the alternative isn't all that great either. But I think I have a Hobbesian choice of making the best, of choosing the lesser of two evils. And I also think about long-term policy changes that don't have anything to do with the presidential race.
When it comes to electoral politics, my line that I stole from actually a comedian, Bob Harris, he actually sent out an email, but which I made my calling card regarding opinions of elections and your involvement, is democracy is more than what you do in a voting booth on a Tuesday in November. It is what you do with your hands and with your heart and with your head every day, all year long. It's not going to just be won on November 8th, regardless what happens. It's going to be won on November 9th and November 10th and every day thereafter, with all the actions you take, big and small, thereafter, all of us.
Mitchell, I couldn't have said it better myself, and neither can you.
Yeah, I had to steal it because
he's
more eloquent than I am.
On that note, I think I'm going to release you now to your family and send you on your way, and for you to come back maybe soon. We're talking about some other things that happen.
There will be things to talk about, I'm sure.
Yes. But for sure after the election.
Okay.
Either before the inaugural address or maybe after, perhaps before. I'd like to talk about the election, so maybe next month sometime.
Okay.
In the meantime, I'm working on these other, I'm working on other people to come and talk before the election, so hopefully that the stars will align and they will show up too. Because you're not the only voice, Mitchell, I hate to tell you that.
I know.
But you
Thank
are
God.
A definitely great, wonderful voice.
Thank
and
you.
And I had a wonderful time. So thanks so much.
Me too. I'm very glad. Thank you so much.
We're going to switch back to some music again, some music from Cuba, and then we'll play some more wild and crazy freeform music that The Wizard is known for. Yes, you are listening to The Wizard. This is WCRD Chicago 88.3. Finishing up with Mitchell Spanzik from Chicago Media Action, among many other organizations, and talking about politics, the media, and many other interesting things. So thanks so much for tuning in, and thank you again, Mitchell.
You're very welcome.
For this wonderful afternoon of chatter and deep talk. All right, so let's get to the music. Let's get back to the music. And so again, thank you for listening, and thank you, Mitchell.